Monster Man, special episode, Monsters of Tecumel. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters. And in particular, Patreon backer Stan. Stan has asked me to talk about the monsters of Tecumel. Before we begin, I want to make one thing very clear. Tecumel is beloved by... I hate to call it a cult game setting, but it kind of is, in that it has a comparatively small fan base who love it dearly. It's sort of like an even more concentrated Glorantha. One of the things that the fans of Tecumel love about the game and its setting is its linguistic richness. Tecumel was designed, as we're about to cover, by a linguist, and it has... There are a number of fictitious languages, for the setting the most important of which is Tsolyani. I have read some stuff on Tsolyani pronunciation. I'm almost certainly going to get it wrong throughout this episode. And I am telling you right now, Tecumel lovers, I respect you and your attachment to this wonderful setting, but I don't want to hear about it. Don't at me. Please accept in advance my apologies for getting it wrong, but this is all recorded in the past. I can't correct it. So we're all just going to have to live with it. Let's do a little bit of background. What is Tecumel? Tecumel was created by a fellow called M.A.R. Barker. Barker was a linguist, specifically an expert in languages like Urdu. He wrote several books on Urdu. I believe he also studied Pashto. So he was an expert on South and Central Asian languages. And he follows a familiar, I would say, in some ways, profile for an early role-playing game designer. He was fascinated by history and folklore from a young age. He was a war gamer. He loved to create fictitious histories for his kind of imaginary cultures. And of course, once he became interested in linguistics, also languages for those cultures. And I think they kind of fed on each other. He even went so far as to make his own miniatures for these imaginary games. He's usually credited as M.A.R. Barker. His name was Muhammad Abdul Rahman Barker. He changed it when he converted to Islam in his 20s. So he was someone who was in an excellent position to draw when creating his fantasy world, not on the same kind of influences that other creators were drawing on at that time, right? So if you think about people like Gary Gygax or Dave Arneson or whoever, they're drawing on folklore, they're drawing on popular culture, and they're drawing on a love of medieval Europe. But that wasn't Barker's deal at all. And so he drew on parts of the history of the Indian subcontinent and also Central America. So for example, the Tsolyani language, in addition to Urdu and Pashto, is influenced by languages like Mayan and Nahuatl. Note, Maya people, Mayan language. I tried to keep that consistent when we did these on patron deities, but I'm sure it wasn't perfect. Anyway, he had already been involved in some kinds of like proto role-playing in the 1970s. And I think, you know, it seems to have been doing the rounds within the Wargaming confraternity, right? That Wargamers were starting to move in a role-playing-like direction. And then when he encountered people who played Dungeons & Dragons, this was when he was at the University of Minnesota, it seemed like a natural fit. And Tecumel, I believe, has the distinction of being the first published role-playing game setting. He self-published it in 1974, TSR then published a revised edition in 1975, and it's been through like 9 other publishers since then. 5 different RPGs set in Tecumel have come out. Barker also wrote 5 Tecumel novels. He passed away in 2012. Now, the history of Tecumel, the setting, that is to say that it's in setting history, is a very complex one and is, you know, too much to go into in detail here, but essentially, Tecumel is at least theoretically a science fiction setting rather than a fantasy one. That is, this is an alien world that was colonized by humans, and then they brought species from all over the universe to that world. But then there was this calamity, and Tecumel was cut off from that interstellar human society, with the result that it, you know, basically it had an apocalypse without the necessary various supplies that it had to import its technologically advanced society fell into a state of kind of, you know, a medievalish level of technology. And it's been thousands and thousands of years since that catastrophe, which is why the world of Tecamel is full of, like, underground ruins and things like that, right? They're the subterranean complexes of an earlier age, well, among other things. Like I said, it's complicated. And similarly, why there are all these strange animals and other creatures, because of the various exotic animals that were brought to Tecamel from all over the universe by its colonists, plus the planet's indigenous wildlife. So this is a complex setting with many human and non-human empires. If I had to describe the overall aesthetic of Tecamel, I would say that it is unfamiliar. You know, it is an alien world, it's full of alien species, strange creatures fulfill the role that in another fantasy role-playing game would be fulfilled by a horse. Although there are dogs and cats on Tecamel, because, you know, presumably wherever Earthlings go, so go our faithful pets. Similarly, its languages are based on languages that I think it is fair to say most of Barker's audience don't speak. So, you know, unlike, you know, Warhammer with its Cod German and Cod Latin, or D&D with its various kind of faux old-timey Anglicisms, which have the ring of the familiar even if they're not actually authentic, Tecamel has the ring of the exotic to most of its readers. I hate to call things exotic because, of course, things aren't exotic to the people who are familiar with them. But we can only use that term relative to a particular audience, and I think that for most people who have bought and love Tecamel, these are unfamiliar influences. And then they are, you know, made stranger still by the weird alien setting. I have some more thoughts of this, which I will talk about later on. Now, the book that I am looking at is the 1992 Tecamel Bestiary by M.A.R. Barker and Victor Raymond. It contains 140-odd monsters, and its monster entries contain no game statistics. So this is not really an aid for playing a particular role-playing game. It is a guide to the imaginary world of Tecamel. And as a result, we're about to see a lot of creatures that don't really have the kind of game relevance that we would normally expect, even from a book that casts its nets as wide as the Monster Manual. Let's take the Bajak, for example. This is a creature a bit like a six-legged Styracosaurus, and Bajak are used on Tecamel as mounts and beasts of burden. This entry gives us detailed information on their reproductive cycle, on their anatomy. It even mentions the position that they sleep in. When I was a kid, I was very fascinated by this book called Expedition by Wayne Barlow. I don't know who wrote the text. I'd have to look it up. But I'm sure I've mentioned it before on this show. Maybe it was Wayne Barlow. Wayne Barlow is an artist probably best known for doing the monster designs for Pacific Rim, at least to modern audiences. But it's a fictional record of an expedition to an alien planet where, you know, other life forms are just all going around doing life-formy things, right? Living their weird lives. And there's no real narrative through line. There's no conflict, really. It's just a beautiful exploration of an imaginary science fictional world. That's kind of how I feel about the Bajak. It's just kind of there to remind you that you're not in Kansas anymore. A player goes, I run outside and jump on my horse. And they go, well, you jump on your Bajak. Another example would be something like the Kurune. This is a bird, and it's got a great description, which says that it is edible, parentheses, barely. And we're told it is brown, white, black, and tan in color. It is said to be beloved by the god Tumis. And that's it. That's the entry. It's a bird. So this is the level of detail that we're looking at in the Tecamel Bestiary. It's got, you know, the ordinary birds in the trees are special weird birds. And of course there is lore about them. You know, when you're talking to the local people, they will tell you that that bird is edible, but it doesn't taste very good. What a great detail. What a thoughtful little piece of information about how the locals would think about the animals in their landscape. So on the one hand, this is an animal that is completely exotic to us, but on the other hand, it is an animal that is completely commonplace to the people of Tecamel, to the point that the first thing they think about is, how good does it taste? What a brilliant little piece of setting evocation, and how absolutely useless in a game. Don't get me wrong, I love Glorantha. I've been in games where I was expected to be a tourist in the fascinating world of Glorantha. You know, admire the sights, see the beautiful Zolofell River Valley, carry Keller Starbrow's luggage, not that one, but... And you can make use of those details. They're so good. Just little, like a couple of those little details to throw in at crucial moments really go a long way toward making the world feel real. But like I said, there's 140 some of these monsters. So I'm torn between admiration of the excellence of this technique and skepticism about its relevance. Now, there are some more conventional monster-like monsters in this book. For example, we've got the Tlacolel, a sort of giant beetle with big blade-like mandibles. And again, great little details from an in-universe perspective. We're told its gleaming black chitin armor gives it the nickname of the Steed of Sarku. I don't know who Sarku is, but if he rides around on a black armored blade mandible giant beetle, he seems like he means business. Or the Dlaken, a segmented worm, the segments of which can split up and run around like separate individuals. That's a really fun concept, right? Each wears a bit sort of like a millipede. Each segment's got a couple of little leggies on it, and they can pop off and run around, even though only the front one has a mouth. Some great stuff there. I like that image. When you look at segmented animals, it does sort of seem like they ought to be able to detach and reattach and combine to form bigger ones and things like that. What a great little image. We've got the Sro, the Dragon King. It's intelligent. It likes to gather shiny objects, but it's not a dragon. We're specifically told it's a, quote, mutant of reptilian stock, close quotes, even though it has kind of a dragon's treasure hoard. And this is something that I think is very important to the world of Tekumel, and something we're going to talk about a little bit more toward the end of this episode. We've got the Mnor, a shaggy insect. They are semi-intelligent tool users. They look a bit like sort of fuzzy caterpillars, and they're hunted for their pelts, which is a bit grim. And we've got some real proper giant monsters, like the Akko, the Embracer of Ships, a sort of sea cucumber kraken kind of creature, which is absolutely horrible. And down in the underworld section of the book, this book is broken up by habitat. And the underworld section is where you get a lot of your monsters. We get things like the Hlir, the beast with the unendurable face. Good name. Look on them and you go insane. They sound very much like ghosties, but we're told that they are actually telepathic creatures whose telepathic abilities do, quote, not jibe with human or other Tekumelani creatures' mental frequencies, close quotes. So again, even though it seems like a ghost, and if you look on it, you go mad, it is the beast with the unendurable face, this may actually be because it has some science fiction-y psionic thing that just makes you, kind of scrambles your brainwaves as an unintended side effect of its presence. And this seems to me, in my inexpert perspective, to be the sort of thread that runs through the monsters of Tekumel. Basically, there are these kind of quote-unquote supernatural elements, but for the most part, what we have here is a science fiction setting that people could interpret as magical or fantastic. Now, this seems like a slim distinction, but it's really interesting to me. The Sro is a flying, lizard-like creature that loves shiny objects and therefore collects gold coins and stuff. Basically, it's a dragon and it has a hoard. But it's not a force of supernatural evil, it's merely an animal that likes shiny objects, much like a magpie does. And there's a lot of that kind of thing, a lot of things that seem monstrous and terrifying, but are fundamentally just weird alien wildlife. A world that could be interpreted by its inhabitants as fantastic, but is for the most part naturalistic, just a completely weird naturalistic. I don't know that I would necessarily run a game using this bestiary, but it is quite an interesting approach. I think it's doubly interesting that this came out so soon after Dungeons & Dragons. You know, one of the things that you get when you... not this book specifically, but Tekumel as a gaming setting. One of the things that you get when you study early kind of para-D&D writing, so what's going on in, you know, White Dwarf in its early issues, what's going on in fanzines or APAs, is you see people's reactions to the game. If we look at the very earliest RPGs, they're mostly reactions in some way to Dungeons & Dragons, and you can see people taking D&D and kind of interpreting it through the lens that they apply to games. So an obvious example would be something like Tunnels and Trolls. So Ken St. Andre gets to see a copy of Dungeons & Dragons, and he goes, this is a good idea, but the execution is much too complex, and it uses all these fancy polyhedral dice that nobody has. I'm going to write a simple one that uses six-sided dice. So we see what Ken St. Andre values. Everybody looks at D&D and sees it as a failed attempt at the thing that they want it to be. The Perrin conventions, right? You look at D&D and you go, that's not how sword fighting works. I know about sword fighting. Or chivalry and sorcery, right? You look at D&D and go, that's not what the Middle Ages were like. And apparently, you know, Greg Stafford and M.A.R. Barker look at D&D and its ilk and go, call that a setting. Hokiest comparison in the world, comparing Tekomel and Glorantha. They're obviously invite comparison with each other, though they're completely different. But in that respect, they are similar, because they're also both settings that predate the games with which they are most closely associated. And that is to say, it's not so much that when Barker discovers Dungeons and Dragons, but when he runs into role-playing games, he understands this is a way to take that fantastic world and interact with it in a way that is creative and spontaneous, that is different from writing a novel set in that world. If we are to understand, as we are so often told we are to understand, early Dungeons & Dragons, early role-playing game, as games of exploration, then ought we not to have somewhere worthy of being explored, right? If you have a bizarre and exotic, fantastical, but maybe not really fantastical setting, then you can tell somebody about it in a long essay or a novel, but that has the risk of becoming something like a history lesson. Or it can be a game, a role-playing game, an interactive game, in which the player is the one exploring and learning more. Where are we going to turn to next? What strange creatures are we going to encounter? What new people and what new customs? And when it is backed by that level of sub-creation, when the person running it knows about, you know, these worlds and these customs and these whatever, then I think that that really is a creative experience of immense potential. But one wants to be very careful that it retains that interactivity and is not merely bird-watching in Tekumel. Is something to be said for that richness. The downside is it's a lot of work to master, right? And there's a high level of investment to really studying Tekumel. It has the problem also that Glorantha used to have, which is that material is not always easily or cheaply available, although I believe that's changing in these days of the internet. It's a fascinating approach to monster design and world design, and it's very interesting that it's one of the earliest. That there is so much diversity in the early days of the hobby. We tend to think of early role-playing games as being essentially just one thing, because that one thing became so powerfully dominant. But it's also a story of designers encountering that thing and thinking, boy, you could do anything with this. And they tried to. This is something that I think about a lot because I'm very interested in the ways that games interact with history. What advantages, what disadvantages are there to a historical game that is something that a player interacts with, as opposed to reading a history book, or taking a history class, or watching a historical film? I'm not talking about accuracy or any of that other nonsense. I'm not sure I believe in historical accuracy. But it would not surprise me to find that people who like Tekumel, as is true to some extent of people who like Glorantha, certainly real diehard Gloranthophiles, are also people who tend to be quite interested in history. Because the way that this is presented is a bit like some kind of travel guide, almost like a book about animals that might exist in reality. I don't have a pithy conclusion, and I feel that in a way that's a testament to the scope of this work, right? Tekumel is such a rich and involved sub-creation and you know, maybe not the most accessibly presented in the world. I don't know that I have the time to invest in really, like, because I feel like, and maybe, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like if you want to get into Tekumel, like, you have to be a Tekumel guy. That has to be your thing. Maybe not your only thing, but that's your thing. You know what I mean? Oh, in fact, you know who was one of the people who really helped me out with some of the Tekumel stuff for this episode? That was John Hancock. And how do I know John Hancock in person? Because we played a Glorantha game together. But anyway, hi, John. Because that's how you used to have to approach Glorantha. Like, I had, like, back in the day, my friend Joel was like my Gloranthan teacher. You know, you had to have someone explain all this incomprehensible nonsense in badly formatted publications to you, and then you could see the beauty beneath it all. Like, I don't want to be all, you young folks don't know how lucky you are, but there was a rough period there for a while, and that's when I got into Glorantha, when nothing that was being published for it made any sense. but the temptation is there. I'm 100 times more likely to become a Tecumel guy than I am to become a Forgotten Realms guy. There are rare settings that you look at and don't think, I could do better. You know, but if I wanted a fantasy setting with inns and dungeons and castles and whatever, those are not hard to create. This thing, though, I don't know, is very interesting. Anyway, so that's an ambiguous conclusion to an episode, because as with so many other subjects that we talk about in the show, I've only scratched the surface here. But I think those are kind of my first impressions, right? An outsider's impression of the Monsters of Tecumel. And Stan, I hope that you enjoyed it. I have to say that I did. You know, it was a lot of fun doing the research for this one and, you know, learning more about Tecumel and its creatures. And it's a really interesting example of another approach to game and setting design than what we're used to. Just remember, if you'd like to be like Stan and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do, you'll also get access to all the rewards for lower tiers. In our next episode, we're gonna be returning to the Creature Catalog, the 1986 supplement for basic Dungeons & Dragons, and we're gonna be talking about the Living Statue and the Magian, or possibly the Mogan, right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.